Listening Comprehension Test. You will hear each recording twice. After each listening, you will have time to complete your answers. Task 1. Tuition Fees. Listen to six young people talking about tuition fees. Match each speaker, 1 to 6, with one of the options, A to G, by putting the corresponding letter in the correct box. For each speaker, there is only one correct answer. There is one more option than you need. You now have time to read the assignment.
Speaker 1.
At my private college, tuition fees were a very good thing. First of all, it was able to give us a lot of excellent equipment in our sports rooms. We were able to exercise using the facilities and had machines to do that. Our cafeterias had an open policy where you could go in and get food at any time. And private fees also ensured that students could receive scholarships who couldn't afford it otherwise. So I think they're an excellent thing.
Speaker 2.
I believe that education is something that everyone should be entitled to, regardless of how much money they have. People don't pay for school, so why should they pay for university? Since Labour introduced tuition fees in 2005, people from poorer families have been put off from going to university. I'll be leaving uni with 30 grand's worth of debt. Thanks a bunch, Labour.
Speaker 3.
In my home state, it's actually written into the Constitution that every person should have the ability to get a quality public education. And because of that, we have built up actually two very quality universities that are some of the best in the country. The problem is that those cost a lot of money now. And because of that, students have to pay very high tuition fees. And I think that that stops normal people from getting this quality education that we want them to get. So if you want everyone to have a quality education, the government has to be willing to pay for it and not students.
Speaker 4.
I think that if the universities want to increase tuition fees, the students need to get better value for money. That means more contact between lecturers and students, better resources. I'm fed up of having to wait for weeks for the only copy of the book I need to do my essays. Free travel to and from the uni. I spent nearly £300 last year commuting to university and back.
Speaker 5.
It costs a reasonable amount to go to university these days, and it can be a heavy burden on an individual. I, for example, have a reasonably large student loan. However, I think if you don't have to pay fees, that it can be hard to find the motivation to work. Putting so much into your education and investing so much really does provide you with real motivation to study, and then you can really make the most of your time at university.
Speaker 6.
I would say that often what happens with tuition fees is that they're used to allow the state to pay less. So, for example, for my university, it's gotten to the point where the state actually pays less than 20% of the actual cost of the university. And every time the state has a problem with money, they pay less to the university and they ask the students to pay more. So we don't get more quality as we pay more. What we get is the same quality, but we're just paying for more of what the university has.
Now listen to the recording again.
Speaker 1.
At my private college, tuition fees were a very good thing. First of all, it was able to give us a lot of excellent equipment in our sports rooms. We were able to exercise using the facilities and had machines to do that. Our cafeterias had an open policy where you could go in and get food at any time. And private fees also ensured that students could receive scholarships who couldn't afford it otherwise. So I think they're an excellent thing.
Speaker 2.
I believe that education is something that everyone should be entitled to, regardless of how much money they have. People don't pay for school, so why should they pay for university? Since Labour introduced tuition fees in 2005, people from poorer families have been put off from going to university. I'll be leaving uni with 30 grand's worth of debt. Thanks a bunch, Labour.
Speaker 3.
In my home state, it's actually written into the Constitution that every person should have the ability to get a quality public education. And because of that, we have built up actually two very quality universities that are some of the best in the country. The problem is that those cost a lot of money now. And because of that, students have to pay very high tuition fees. And I think that that stops normal people from getting this quality education that we want them to get. So if you want everyone to have a quality education, the government has to be willing to pay for it and not students.
Speaker 4.
I think that if the universities want to increase tuition fees, the students need to get better value for money. That means more contact between lecturers and students, better resources. I'm fed up of having to wait for weeks for the only copy of the book I need to do my essays. Free travel to and from the uni. I spent nearly £300 last year commuting to university and back.
Speaker 5.
It costs a reasonable amount to go to university these days, and it can be a heavy burden on an individual. I, for example, have a reasonably large student loan. However, I think if you don't have to pay fees, that it can be hard to find the motivation to work. Putting so much into your education and investing so much really does provide you with real motivation to study, and then you can really make the most of your time at university.
Speaker 6.
I would say that often what happens with tuition fees is that they're used to allow the state to pay less. So, for example, for my university, it's gotten to the point where the state actually pays less than 20% of the actual cost of the university. And every time the state has a problem with money, they pay less to the university and they ask the students to pay more. So we don't get more quality as we pay more. What we get is the same quality, but we're just paying for more of what the university has.
Task 2. American Dream. Listen to the following podcast about young people and the American dream. While listening, tick the correct answer, A, B, C, or D. There is only one correct answer. You now have time to read the assignment.
NPR's Exploring the American Dream. By nature, young people can be idealistic and in many ways epitomize the spirit of the dream. But with the recent recession, surveys find a profound pessimism among many young adults. NPR's Jennifer Ludden has this profile of one woman's fledgling steps to follow her dream.
Growing up near Philadelphia, Michelle Holshue's dream was to serve those in need. And in 2007, applying to nursing school at the University of Pennsylvania seemed like a smart move. Then, of course, the economy tanked. For a time, Holshue was an Ivy League grad on unemployment and food stamps.
But I made it work. I learned to cook really well on a tight budget, which is a skill that's served me ever since.
Holshue found her footing, has held several jobs, and moved recently for a one-year fellowship at a public health association in Washington, D.C. She has her own apartment and two cats in Virginia, an hour's commute from her job. And at 30 years old, Holshue exemplifies a key tenet of the American dream.
My dad never finished high school. So in that sense, I am doing better than my parents did.
She's making more money early on than her parents make after decades of working. Her dad's a school bus driver, her mom a teacher. And yet, like so many college graduates now, Holshue feels her life will be constrained for decades to come because of student loan debt. She opens a thick binder of documents.
And this isn't all of them. I think at last count there was something like 20 different loans.
20 loans totaling $140,000 for both her bachelor's and nursing degrees. Holshue says she's in debt more than her parents ever were when they bought a house. In fact, her monthly student loan payment of $1,100 is nearly as much as her rent.
The first of the month, I might have $100 to live on for 2 weeks, which doesn't even pay my transportation costs.
Holshue says she used to tease her dad, calling him cheap for buying in bulk. Now she's right there with him, a stack of coupons clipped to a refrigerator magnet, a closet full of toilet paper. Despite all this, she says she often has to put food on a credit card. So is she living her dream?
I would say that I am, but it's really hard. Like, living the dream isn't supposed to be so hard.
Part of the American dream is that if you work hard and you get an education and you apply yourself, you'll be successful.
And yet Cliff Zukin of Rutgers University says a third of recent college graduates do not believe that's true for them. Surveying those who graduated between 2006 and 2011, Zukin finds more than half say their generation as a whole will not be as successful as the one before.
Now listen to the recording again.
NPR's Exploring the American Dream. By nature, young people can be idealistic and in many ways epitomize the spirit of the dream. But with the recent recession, surveys find a profound pessimism among many young adults. NPR's Jennifer Ludden has this profile of one woman's fledgling steps to follow her dream.
Growing up near Philadelphia, Michelle Holshue's dream was to serve those in need. And in 2007, applying to nursing school at the University of Pennsylvania seemed like a smart move. Then, of course, the economy tanked. For a time, Holshue was an Ivy League grad on unemployment and food stamps.
But I made it work. I learned to cook really well on a tight budget, which is a skill that's served me ever since.
Holshue found her footing, has held several jobs, and moved recently for a one-year fellowship at a public health association in Washington, D.C. She has her own apartment and two cats in Virginia, an hour's commute from her job. And at 30 years old, Holshue exemplifies a key tenet of the American dream.
My dad never finished high school. So in that sense, you know, I am doing better than my parents did.
She's making more money early on than her parents make after decades of working. Her dad's a school bus driver, her mom a teacher. And yet, like so many college graduates now, Holshue feels her life will be constrained for decades to come because of student loan debt. She opens a thick binder of documents.
And this isn't all of them. I think at last count there was something like 20 different loans.
20 loans totaling $140,000 for both her bachelor's and nursing degrees. Holshue says she's in debt more than her parents ever were when they bought a house. In fact, her monthly student loan payment of $1,100 is nearly as much as her rent.
The first of the month, I might have $100 to live on for 2 weeks, which doesn't even pay my transportation costs.
Holshue says she used to tease her dad, calling him cheap for buying in bulk. Now she's right there with him, a stack of coupons clipped to a refrigerator magnet, a closet full of toilet paper. Despite all this, she says she often has to put food on a credit card. So is she living her dream?
I would say that I am, but it's really hard. Like, living the dream isn't supposed to be so hard.
Part of the American dream is that if you work hard and you get an education and you apply yourself, you'll be successful.
And yet Cliff Zukin of Rutgers University says a third of recent college graduates do not believe that's true for them. Surveying those who graduated between 2006 and 2011, Zukin finds more than half say their generation as a whole will not be as successful as the one before.
Task 3. Engineering and Safety. Listen to the following radio report about engineering and safety. While listening, complete the notes on the points listed on this worksheet. You do not need to write complete sentences. You now have time to read the assignment.
Whether it's a nuclear power plant, or a bridge, or an airplane, engineers have to design things to certain specifications, and they have to grapple with the question of how safe is safe enough. NPR's Joe Pelka has been talking with engineers about that question.
When humans first started building things, determining whether they would work as planned was mostly a matter of trial and error. Build a bridge, drive a chariot across it, and see if the bridge collapsed. Henry Petrosky is a professor of engineering at Duke University. He says now computers and mathematical models can predict how a bridge will behave under different conditions. But Petrosky says if you ask engineers to build a safe bridge or a safe nuclear plant, they ask you what you mean by that.
The definition of safe is not strictly an engineering term, it's a societal term. Does it mean absolutely no loss of life? Does it mean absolutely no contamination by radiation? What exactly does safe mean?
Once you settle that question, engineers still face the problem of deciding how to achieve whatever level of safety they're aiming for. Michael Corradini is a professor of nuclear engineering at the University of Wisconsin. He says first, you design for normal operating conditions.
And then with any engineering design, anything at all, you then say, okay, well, that's fine, that's what it operates on, but what if something happens that it doesn't experience some unusual conditions?
So, for example, let's say you're designing a bridge for a place where gale force winds and heavy snows are virtually unheard of.
But you still design for it so that the bridge safely performs its function, or if it fails, it fails gently, so there's no catastrophic effects.
In other words, the bridge doesn't collapse. Wind and snow are one thing, but what about other kinds of safety threats? How well will a bridge do if terrorists try to blow it up? What happens if operators in a nuclear plant control room suddenly get sick? What if a meteorite falls on the plant? Corradini says nuclear power plant designers try to think of everything.
They have a listing of all the things that they think can go wrong and how they can go wrong, and some sort of ordered list of which is more likely than others.
But sometimes, when you set out to build a nuclear power plant, you don't know exactly what the likelihood of a particular calamity might be. Yotaro Hatamura is an emeritus professor of engineering at the University of Tokyo. He says engineers sometimes don't pay enough attention to history in making their assumptions. He favors what he calls backward thinking. The reactor core might survive an earthquake, but what about the pumps that provide cooling water to the reactor? Or what about the backup generators that provide emergency power to the pumps? Or what about the fuel supply for the emergency generators? He says accidents happen when engineers don't constantly test and revise the assumptions they've made about all the things that a nuclear plant needs to operate. Hatamura says it's not always easy to look back and admit to problems that you should have thought of in the first place.
Now listen to the recording again.
Whether it's a nuclear power plant, or a bridge, or an airplane, engineers have to design things to certain specifications, and they have to grapple with the question of how safe is safe enough. NPR's Joe Palka has been talking with engineers about that question.
When humans first started building things, determining whether they would work as planned was mostly a matter of trial and error. Build a bridge, drive a chariot across it, and see if the bridge collapsed. Henry Petrosky is a professor of engineering at Duke University. He says now computers and mathematical models can predict how a bridge will behave under different conditions. But Petrosky says if you ask engineers to build a safe bridge or a safe nuclear plant, they ask you what you mean by that.
The definition of safe is not strictly an engineering term, it's a societal term. Does it mean absolutely no loss of life? Does it mean absolutely no contamination by radiation? What exactly does safe mean?
Once you settle that question, engineers still face the problem of deciding how to achieve whatever level of safety they're aiming for. Michael Corradini is a professor of nuclear engineering at the University of Wisconsin. He says first, you design for normal operating conditions.
And then with any engineering design, anything at all, you then say, okay, well, that's fine. That's what it operates on. But what if something happens that it doesn't experience some unusual conditions?
So, for example, let's say you're designing a bridge for a place where gale force winds and heavy snows are virtually unheard of.
But you still design for it so that the bridge safely performs its function, or if it fails, it fails gently, so there's no catastrophic effects.
In other words, the bridge doesn't collapse. Wind and snow are one thing, but what about other kinds of safety threats? How well will a bridge do if terrorists try to blow it up? What happens if operators in a nuclear plant control room suddenly get sick? What if a meteorite falls on the plant? Corradini says nuclear power plant designers try to think of everything.
They have a listing of all the things that they think can go wrong and how they can go wrong, and some sort of ordered list of which is more likely than others.
But sometimes, when you set out to build a nuclear power plant, you don't know exactly what the likelihood of a particular calamity might be. Yotaro Hatamura is an emeritus professor of engineering at the University of Tokyo. He says engineers sometimes don't pay enough attention to history in making their assumptions. He favors what he calls backward thinking. The reactor core might survive an earthquake, but what about the pumps that provide cooling water to the reactor? Or what about the backup generators that provide emergency power to the pumps? Or what about the fuel supply for the emergency generators? He says accidents happen when engineers don't constantly test and revise the assumptions they've made about all the things that a nuclear plant needs to operate. Hatamura says it's not always easy to look back and admit to problems that you should have thought of in the first place.
Task 4. Question time. Question time is an opportunity for members of Parliament, MPs, to ask the Prime Minister, PM, questions. Listen to a question that an MP asked at the House of Commons and to the PM's answer. While listening, tick the correct answer, A, B, C, or D. There is only one correct answer. You now have time to read the assignment.
Order. Questions to the Prime Minister. Mr. Philip Hollabone.
Number one, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Under rules introduced in 2003, illegal migrants who managed to avoid the authorities for 14 years are able to apply for permanent stay, have full access to the welfare system, and can even obtain a British passport. Given that in the last 8 years, nearly 10,000 such migrants have won such rights, and with an estimated 500,000 illegal immigrants in Britain today, will the Prime Minister seek to change these rules and restore some sanity to Britain's border controls?
Yeah. Well, my honourable friend makes an important point, and we have pledged to break the link between temporary migration and permanent settlement in the UK, because we believe that settling in Britain should be a privilege rather than an automatic right if you've evaded the authorities for a certain amount of time. We're going to consult on further measures, including the future of the 14-year rule that he mentions, and we'll make announcements later this year. We've already announced there will be tighter rules for those wanting to settle here and have already implemented a new income and English language requirement for skilled workers who've been here for more than 5 years.
Now, listen to the recording again.
Order. Questions to the Prime Minister. Mr. Philip Hollabone.
Number one, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Under rules introduced in 2003, illegal migrants who managed to avoid the authorities for 14 years are able to apply for permanent stay, have full access to the welfare system, and can even obtain a British passport. Given that in the last 8 years, nearly 10,000 such migrants have won such rights, and with an estimated 500,000 illegal immigrants in Britain today, will the Prime Minister seek to change these rules and restore some sanity to Britain's border controls?
Yeah. Well, my honourable friend makes an important point, and we have pledged to break the link between temporary migration and permanent settlement in the UK, because we believe that settling in Britain should be a privilege rather than an automatic right if you've evaded the authorities for a certain amount of time. We're going to consult on further measures, including the future of the 14-year rule that he mentions, and we'll make announcements later this year. We've already announced there will be tighter rules for those wanting to settle here and have already implemented a new income and English language requirement for skilled workers who've been here for more than 5 years.
This is the end of your listening comprehension test.